I'm Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. Josh Barrow is away this week. It's the last week of August, and it started with the G7 summit and headline-grabbing fires in the Amazon. Polling that seemed to indicate the Democratic primary had become a toss-up also dominated headlines, before more polling showed one candidate dominating the field. Meanwhile, other candidates got shut out of the next debate, but vowed to press on, while others decided to throw in the towel. And is the love affair between President Trump and Fox News over? We're going to be discussing all of this news in just a moment. And later in the show, we'll be interviewing a prominent screenwriter on his efforts to teach Democratic candidates how to rise above the noise of Twitter and tell stories that connect with voters in the heartland. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your center for today, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left is Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Kelly.
Rich, you have an interesting column this week in which you made me laugh out loud by critiquing the political strategy of French President Emmanuel Macron through a comparison with both Diddy and Leonardo DiCaprio. Something you don't see every day. Why don't you tell our listeners about it?
Well, I think Macron fell prey to this celebrity panic over the Amazon fires that was deeply misinformed. The level of fires this year is not really remarkable. It's actually lower than levels we saw in the 2000s. It's not true that these fires are spontaneously starting because of global warming. They're man-lit fires. Most of them don't really involve the jungle. They are people clearing, using fires to further clear areas that have already been cleared. Now, that does speak to deforestation. That's not great, but this isn't doesn't speak to us being on the verge of a planetary catastrophe. And almost all these tweets, including Macron, referred to the Amazon as the lungs of the planet, which isn't true, and referred to this factoid that the Amazon's supposedly responsible for 20% of our oxygen, which also isn't true. And Macron, on the basis of all this misleading information, made the Amazon fires a major agenda item in the G7 summit. So it just seemed to me a great example of how elite opinion, even at the highest levels of Western government, can be moved by fashionable opinion that's not very well informed.
So I did want to, it's interesting that you're talking about opinion leaders, because I was going to say that I'm someone who believes the science on climate change, but I have to say that climate change has actually never come up as a major issue among any of the voters in my family. They are, for the most part, diehard, Democratic voters. I've never literally heard them mention that at any time discussing any election. And there was a survey I found from Yale University before the midterms that said that 38% of voters polled identified climate change as a very important issue. But when they were asked to rank issues of importance, climate change was actually ranked 15th out of 28, which seems to indicate it actually is not that important to a lot of voters. So I hate it when people talk about liberal bias in media, because I know plenty of people in media, yourself included, who do not identify as liberal. But I do wonder if some of the breathless and sometimes inaccurate tweets are driven by the fact that it is considered the sort of issue du jour of people in places like New York and Malibu.
Well, that's part of it. I also just think that advocates for action on climate change know that if you actually have a really responsible accounting of the state of the science, it's complicated. It's clearly we have warming and there's a man-made element of it, but that's not really a catalyzing force. So they're desperate for mediagenic, easy to understand planetary catastrophes. And they thought, in the images of these fires, that they had one. It's just, if you actually, a rigorous scientific factual account of what's going on in the Amazon does not support the hysteria. And many of the photos shared, actually including Macron's photo that he shared with his tweet, were not of the current Amazon fires.
Liz, what do you make of the intense coverage of that story this week? And then I want to follow up with another question about how that percolated in the news.
Well, I think that the politics of the Amazon fires have been jarring, with Bolsonaro refusing to take aid based on some remarks Macron made. I think that exemplifies to quite a few people the sort of conflict between these far-right some people have called Bolsonaro pseudo-fascist, but certainly right populist politicians, and then the remainder of the global community that seems more committed to liberal democracy. So I think that the fires themselves are extremely concerning. They certainly bring to the fore climate change issues that have been very prominent in the Democratic primaries, with the release of several plans for bold climate action. But they've also highlighted more of that political rift that we've been seeing since the election of Trump between right populists and liberal Democrats.
Around the world.
Around the world, right. Little d, Democrats.
Well, and I was going to follow up by asking about the spat between Bolsonaro and Macron regarding the First Lady of France. Brazilian President Bolsonaro has been criticized for engaging in social media and in comments that were seen as sexist regarding the First Lady of France's age. And actually, I noticed today that women of Brazil have been apologizing on Twitter on behalf of their president, which kind of brought everything full circle with women apologizing for what a man said about another woman. But I was going to ask, what did you make of that dispute?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly very familiar to anyone who's spent a few years with Trump as president, right? we all know how that goes at this point. And so, I mean, I'm fairly inured. Trump says, you know, makes remarks that are off color all the time, to say the very least, about other world figures and Americans. And women's appearances, right. I mean, it's certainly a type of attack you can lodge, especially if you want to go after Macron's masculinity, which seemed to be the point. So, I mean, not surprising, completely obnoxious, and ultimately a distraction from the actual politics that are playing out here.
So there's been some interesting news in American politics this week as well. What caught your eye in terms of the presidential election this week?
So the summer is winding down, and so is the Democratic primary field. After former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper and Washington Governor Jay Inslee, the latest to drop out is New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Gillibrand's drop is probably a symptom of the unique nature of what's increasingly looking like a three-person race. While voters have their pick of fairly traditional Democrats, the two bold progressives Sanders and Warren have ticked up and up, set the tone for debates, and led headlines. Gillibrand seemed to recognize this. During the last debate, she seemed to lean in a dramatically progressive direction, but ultimately she was a cautious, shrewd Democrat in the mold of Hillary Clinton. And she was never able to break through the din of more than a dozen similar Democrats, the most prominent of which is former Vice President Biden. But Biden's slipping, and his support is fanning out among the remainder of the field, including Sanders and Warren. Meanwhile, Harris, who enjoyed a fulsome polling bump after her explosive performance in the first debate, has dropped back in the single digits. Where it goes from here is anybody's guess, but my read on the polls is that bold progressives in the race are well positioned heading into the fall.
Interesting. Now, I'll be honest, I'm a New York voter and I care about women's issues. I did not find Senator Gillibrand to be a particularly compelling candidate, but I do feel it's important to address one of the theories regarding the collapse of her campaign. What do you make of the narrative, Liz, that she struggled in the presidential race in part because donors and supporters of Al Franken punished her for being the first senator to call for his resignation due to sexual misconduct allegations? Do you think there's any truth to that? And if so, do you think that's fair?
I think that is likely very true. I think that Gillibrand was outspoken not only about Al Franken, and that obviously angered major Democratic donors and party players, but she was also outspoken at one point about Bill Clinton, having been, you know, a person who, if he had come around during the era of Me Too, might have experienced a very different legacy and place in history. And I think that similarly alienated members of the Democratic Party who could have helped her fundraise. And so I do think that did lead to her struggling somewhat in the primaries. But I don't think that if she hadn't done that, she necessarily would have stayed in the race much longer than she did, because there was also the issue of struggling to differentiate her campaign from a lot of similar campaigns.
See, it's interesting because if she was punished for essentially standing up to someone who had some credible allegations of sexual misconduct, that in and of itself could be perceived as somewhat of a form of sexism towards her, right? But I don't know if I ever fully bought that that's what bogged her down as much as the fact that she was seen as an opportunist and sort of like a Tracy Flick type, because that was always sort of her MO for people in New York politics who've been following her a long time, that she flip-flop on so many major issues, you know, not just Evolve, but literally was like, I'd like to be a senator, so I've changed my position on gay rights and guns. But I do wonder, having said that, if women candidates are punished more for being seen as opportunistic and ambitious than male candidates are, which still means her gender played a role. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. I mean, I do think you could say her gender played a role, especially since she positioned herself as a champion for women's rights. That was a lot of the energy of her campaign, and her opposition to Franken, her calling for his resignation, was based on that aspect of her advocacy. And I mean, women being seen as opportunists tend to get a lot more in the way of accusations of duplicity and two-facedness. And these are insults that have dogged women for thousands of years. Women are liars. Women are secretive. Women have top secret agendas that they reveal at the last moment. They operate on cunning instead of out and out aggression. So, I mean, I do think that could have factored into her struggle for support. But this primary has had a record number of women candidates, mm-hmm. and several of them are still in the race and doing pretty well. So, the most exemplary of which is Elizabeth Warren. So I do think women can make it. It doesn't mean gender didn't factor into how Kirsten Gillibrand came out of this race.
Rich, John Podoritz, who's a conservative, had an interesting column in the New York Post this week. He basically chided members of the media for being so excited that one poll showed Biden tied with two other candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And he pointed out that Biden had maintained a significant lead in over 60 polls over 4 months, and that two other polls released right after the tie poll showed that he still holds his lead. He kind of argued that there's this sort of glee in media for a horse race, and that's what's leading to people sort of holding a ticker tape parade when there seems to be Biden slipping.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the phenomenon. And polling experts who poured cold water on that Monmouth poll that had the race basically a three-way tie turned out to be right. You had polls showing Biden up by 13 and 18 in fairly short order. But there have been two other polls last couple days that show the lead 4 and 7. But you got to average it out, and it's a double-digit lead if you average out the polls, and it's been remarkably stable over the last several months, despite a poor first debate performance, despite gaffes, despite there hasn't been time for this to sink in, but probably won't have any effect either, despite Biden completely botching a war story that the Washington Post reported about the other day. So I think if you just look at the polling, you'd think nothing has really happened in this race except for Elizabeth Warren steadily gaining. And I give her better odds of winning the nomination at this point than Biden does, because my perhaps simplistic belief based on the Obama phenomenon and the Trump phenomenon is there's no substitute for just lighting people up. And you're really seeing signs of that with Warren now. Crowds of, estimated 12,000, 15,000 people, really big crowds. So she's clearly catching on. And maybe it's because I also won a horse race and want something interesting, but I also just legitimately can't believe that Biden's going to lead this thing pillar to post without severe disruption at some point.
Well, can I ask you, why have the gaffes not hurt him worse so far? Because the first debate was pretty bad, and it hasn't been really great since. So,
yeah, I mean, the first debate was bad, but also I think as always happens in these events, gets magnified after the fact. So it was bad at the time, but then the coverage makes it seem so much worse as a total debacle. And just, I don't think average Democrats experienced it that way. The gaffes, it's clearly going to be a narrative. Certainly, if he makes it to the general, Trump will use this narrative for all it's worth, that Biden's losing it and is out of his mind. But they're fairly innocuous things, most of them. He's standing in New Hampshire and says, it's a beautiful day here in Vermont, So it's just like that in and of itself is not going to crash his support. It's just I consider him, he's a clear front runner, but I consider him a fragile front runner because the energy clearly is on the left of the party. The next debate here, almost all the moderate candidates besides Biden and Klobuchar are gone and probably never be heard from again. And it's Sanders and Warren who are in the strong second.
But can I ask a question though about then what happens with Black voters? Should it come down to those three? Because Bernie Sanders has consistently struggled with Black voters, and I don't see him making inroads. I think Kamala Harris did some real damage to Biden on the busing thing, with which a lot of young African-American people didn't even know what that was until that. Although Biden's held on in a way I wasn't entirely sure he would with a lot of Black voter support.
Yeah.
I know a lot of older Black voters who still like him. And then when it comes to women of color, I don't think Elizabeth Warren has adequately addressed the fact that she essentially lied about being a racial minority to advance her career. And I think that if all of the candidates of color get knocked out of the race, I'm just a little bit curious about what happens to Black voters when they are still the base of the Democratic Party, because none of them have really...
This is a huge question. And if I knew the answer to it, I'd have a much better idea what's going to happen eventually in this nomination fight. But the question is, are Black voters attached to Biden the way they were attached initially to Hillary in 08? Look strong. She can win. We have a practical side. So we're with her and now with him. Or is it a deeper connection? And is it or is it just that Sanders and Warren, just no matter what, even if they one of them were to win Iowa or win New Hampshire and really look like a much stronger candidate than they even do today, that they won't flip African Americans to them even in that circumstance? So I don't know the answer to that question, but it's obviously one of the top two or three questions that will determine how this nomination battle goes.
I gave up predicting anything after I, like many people, incorrectly predicted Donald Trump would not be president, but I will say this. I actually think that if it's looking really, really tight, I predict the wild card is someone in the Obama sphere steps up for Biden. And I don't know that it'll be President Obama, but I think does something that nods to the community to say, you can trust him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that nod is. It could even just be something that someone says in an interview that makes it clear that they trust him and African Americans can trust him. That's just a theory. I could be totally wrong because I've been wrong before. The story I've been watching this week is about one of the most enduring love affairs in American politics, which appears to be coming to an end. Using his favorite media outlet, Twitter, the president tweeted this week that the new Fox News is letting millions of great people down. We have to start looking for a new news outlet. Fox isn't working for us anymore. Fox News analyst Brett Hume fired back on Twitter that Fox News isn't supposed to work for you, but he was not the only one.
First of all, Mr. President, we don't work for you. I don't work for you. My job is to cover you, not fawn over you or rip you, just report on you, to call balls and strikes on you. My job, Mr. President, our job here is to keep the scores, not settle scores.
That was Fox News' Neil Cavuto sounding very fired up and impassioned in a segment aimed directly at President Trump. So, Liz, is one of the greatest love stories of our time coming to an end?
I don't know. I imagine Fox will be pretty chastened by Trump coming after them. Any journalistic outlet or an outlet that wants to purport itself as a journalistic outlet is going to have to hit back at a statement like that by saying, we do independent journalism and we don't work for you. And to some extent, there is independent reporting done by Fox. That's certainly the case. But the opinion side of Fox, the bent and the slant, is completely in favor of the right, if not the institutional Republican Party. And I doubt that they'll want to lose their viewership by turning on their good old-fashioned dance partner. So I assume they'll continue to dance with the ones that brung them.
Aaron Blake of The Washington Post had a really interesting piece this week, Rich, in which he analyzed Trump supporters and their cable news habits. And while he describes the relationship between Fox and Trump as beneficial to both of them, he actually made a really compelling case based on the data that Fox will remain the number one cable news network without Donald Trump. Donald Trump cannot be reelected without Fox News's help to some degree. What do you make of that?
Well, I think this is it's part of an ongoing shadow struggle that began when Trump first really caught on in the Republican primaries and when Roger Ailes was still the head of Fox over control of Fox effectively, with Trump actually more than anyone else ever had having a greater influence on the Fox audience than anyone, and therefore kind of representing a threat to Fox. At the same time, there was a huge overlap of interests and audience and issues. So Trump needs Fox. I think this is part of him working the refs. And there are a lot of people there who, like Neil Cavuto and Brett Baer, who do really good work.
And Chris Wallace.
Journalists, and Chris Wallace, of course. But then the primetime programming, like the other networks, is opinion. And that's very pro-Trump, and that's never going to change. And Trump's never, there's no alternative Fox. I mean, there's this One America network that he sometimes pitches or plays up, but no one knows what that is. No one's ever going to watch that. So this relationship, they're yoked together, Trump and Fox, but there are going to be tensions. And Trump, you know, he watches it all day long and he doesn't like seeing anything. He doesn't like seeing polls that he doesn't like. He doesn't like seeing Democrats if he doesn't like them. So this is legitimate on his part, legitimate irritation. But as I say, it's also working the refs, trying to get in their heads. And if he can, tilt it even further in his direction.
We have to take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about the complicated relationship between evangelical voters and Donald Trump. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff, columnist at The Daily Beast. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. Liz, I want to start by commending you on such a well-reported piece, and I encourage everyone listening to read it. You did some deep reporting in the state of Texas, where we're both from, where you met with evangelical pastors, you talked to evangelical parishioners, and the end result is this fabulous new piece in the Post titled, In God's Country, Evangelicals View Trump as Their Protector. Will they stand by him in 2020? Will they? I actually discussed your piece with my mom, who occasionally teaches Sunday school back in Texas. We are practicing Christians, have visited evangelical churches, but don't identify as evangelicals ourselves, which I learned from your article is not unusual because African Americans make up a very small percentage of evangelicals. And yet there was something in your piece that resonated with both of us. You wrote about the fact that a lot of Christians have felt bullied socially in the years leading up to the election of Donald Trump. And you cited a Pew survey that found that half of Americans, including a third who lean Democratic, do believe Christians face some form of discrimination. Now, especially in New York and LA, I have absolutely had people make remarks to me about religious Christians, particularly our perceived, you know, ignorance, that would probably be considered un-PC to make about other groups. Can you talk about how this specifically helped fuel Donald Trump's election?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the dominant culture that you get out of sort of mainstream pop, film, TV, music, literature, the people who are doing culture production definitely don't perceive committed Christians as on the vanguard of social change, which is, you know, the thing that is good. So I think that that can be taken very personally. I understand that. I'm a practicing Catholic myself. I think that people are very, very sensitive to when other people, especially people in positions of power, look down on them. And I think that Trump was very able to harness that resentment and those feelings of inferiority. And even though he's not a Christian himself in any detectable way, he was able to take the resentment that Christians felt, especially white evangelicals, and make it an issue they could vote their way out of. And not by becoming the dominant group in society. You know, I spoke to Robert Jeffress, who's one of Trump's biggest evangelical supporters. He's the pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas. And he said they don't want to retake the country for God. That's no longer the game plan for evangelicals. They're not even looking towards a great awakening or a renewal in America. What they're looking for is a space where they can do what they want to do and an accommodation carved out for them. And I think that Trump was able to take the resentment that a lot of evangelicals felt based on how evangelicals are depicted in pop culture and transform that into an energy that they could pour into his campaign. And he promised them accommodations. He promised them that their enemies wouldn't have the last laugh, that they would get what they wanted, and that they would have some power to manifest their own lives. And so I think that's what happened.
To me, one of the most fascinating sections in your piece is when an evangelical minister who did not vote for Trump in 2016, but did a write-in for Evan McMullen, who people might remember won the support of a lot of disillusioned members of the Mormon faith. He said he plans to support Trump this time around, and I want to read exactly what you wrote. The things he strongly disagrees with Trump on, immigration and threats to infringe upon the religious liberty of Muslims via travel bans, have been, in his view, mostly unsuccessful. Thus, he reasoned, many of the excesses he worried about in 2016 now seem unlikely to unfold. So with Trump delivering more than evangelical skeptics had expected and causing less damage than they had feared, Barber now feels more open to casting his vote for the incumbent in 2020. Which leads me to a question for you, Rich. You were a vocal Trump critic in the last presidential election, devoting an entire issue of your publication to how problematic his candidacy was. Do you feel like this evangelical minister, though, that Trump has not been as bad as you thought and actually better than you hoped?
Well, it's been two things. The substantive upside has been considerable. He's been faithful to his coalition and delivered on the issues most important to it, whereas I thought he would kind of tone it down at least a little bit in terms of his tweets and his personal conduct, and he hasn't tried at all. So I do have a similar feeling. So a lot of people quoted in Liz's story, and I think kind of the most important factor there among evangelicals was just partisanship. They, a lot of them were the last to come around to Trump. They supported, you know, Cruz or Rubio, and as they fell off, they were faced with the choice between Trump and Hillary, and they just didn't consider that a very close choice for a lot of issues, and abortion was really a prominent issue, and Trump just has been a rock on that issue, and they kind of, I would prefer, like Jeffress and others go on TV, and they play up Trump like he's this figure out of the Bible, you know, Cyrus or David, who had their flaws, but wonderful men of God. And it just seems to me the more realistic case is look, there are moral downsides to having Trump president of the United States, and it requires significant compromises to support him, but we still consider him better than the alternative. But, you know, a lot of evangelicals are just really bonded to him because they feel as though he's done some things no other Republican president would do, even though they promised them. They feel as though he has the right enemies and critics. They feel as though even when we've had more upstanding Christian men as president, George W. Bush, they were called racist. They were accused of having designs to establish a theocracy in America. So why even try to play nice with the other side or with the press if you're going to get excoriated anyway.
But I was also surprised at how much they seemed to actually think that those men were too nice to get the job done. That's actually what surprised me more.
Yeah, so there's that element as well, that Trump has done some things, embassy to Jerusalem, pulling out of the Iran deal, pulling out of the Paris Accords, that no other president would do, and it's a function of what a wild character he is, and that only such a wild character could withstand the assault that has come from the other side. Not everyone feels that way, but that is certainly a strong element of this phenomenon.
I want to pose a philosophical question to both of you because it's one I've struggled with as a voter, and I know I'm not alone. And I feel like it gets to the core of what your piece is really about, Liz, which is, for example, I'm a huge Jimmy Carter fan because he's a good human being who has dedicated his life to teaching Sunday school, building houses, and public service. Plenty of people say he wasn't the greatest president. I wasn't around then. But what is actually smarter for a voter and what is best for the country? Voting for leaders who are decent human beings, but either you may not agree with policy-wise, or are you better off voting for someone you may know to be a jerk, but either you agree with them policy-wise, or they're just a brilliant policy wonk, and so you know they'll get things done?
Well, a president's role doesn't really come down very much to policy wonkery. They get to set agendas, and they have a huge role in foreign policy, but they can't ram through legislation without Congress. So that's, I guess, a technical point, and maybe it's a way of eliding what is a really difficult question, which is, can you morally allow yourself to vote for someone you know to be morally problematic individual. I mean, nobody's perfect, but there are there are gradations of iniquity among politicians. I think that knowingly giving more power to someone you're well aware will abuse it is a moral hazard. And at the same time, that might be the person who would also, on the other hand, wield power in the more respectable way politically. So I think it's very complicated, and I think it has to come down to a case-by-case judgment, and it's hard to set a firm principle that you have to follow every time, because the situations just change.
And it's interesting because when Trump was elected and there was a lot of talk about how anyone who voted for him was racist, I pointed out the millions of voters who voted for him who had voted for Barack Obama in the previous election. But I also pointed out something else, which is I said, I know I have plenty of friends that I know personally who, if the choice was between a candidate who made a racist comment but was pro-choice and a candidate who had not and was pro-life, they're not voting for the pro-life candidate. Now, they may not say that to my face. They may be embarrassed about it. But it seemed very hard for people to kind of admit that. I also have to just say for the record, and I know a lot of people are going to be mad to hear this, if Sarah Palin had done what Elizabeth Warren did to advance her career, it would be mentioned nonstop by most people on the left. So I actually think both parties struggle with this sort of litmus test when it comes to morality and people who are really good on the issues. Because when it comes to progressive issues, Elizabeth Warren's really good for progressives. Do you have any thoughts, Rich, on what the sort of?
Well, I mean, you saw a test case in the 90s when Bill Clinton, conducted an affair with an intern, lied about it, perjured himself about it. And Democratic Party, there's some voices that were very upset by this. There are some op-ed columnists who condemned him. But at the end of the day, the entire party stood behind him just because of this kind of negative partisanship we were talking about.
And he's been accused of assault allegations, too, as well.
Right, which weren't taken very seriously at the time, but they hated Newt Gingrich more. They opposed Newt Gingrich's agenda. And even though in theory you would have had Al Gore president, and he believed all the same things that Bill Clinton did, just that there was that rally around the flag effect, and we're seeing the same thing every day with Trump. Not the most edifying thing. Maybe ideally that's not the way it should work, but that's the way it does work.
Still with me on the left, Liz Brunick of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich, what's your tweet?
So my tweet is from someone who goes by AG Conservative on Twitter, and he was tweeting about a new poll showing the new British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, a little bit underwater in the polls at a -6% rating, but the leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, at -59. And AG tweets, the thing about the opposition being led by a pro-terrorist anti-Semite is that it gives the governing party a lot of leeway.
Wow. Liz, what's your tweet of the week?
Our president, Donald Trump, in his ongoing war against my employer, the Washington Post, tweeted, "The Amazon, Washington Post, and CNN just did a fake interview on pardons for aides on the wall, and that I didn't think the wall on the southern border was that important to stop illegals wanting to come into our country. Wrong, vitally important, will make big impact. So bad." A tip from the Amazon, Washington Post, try a copy editor.
My tweet of the week comes courtesy of Fox 5 DC and accompanies a now viral photo of two adorable little boys who happen to be of different races, holding hands. The tweet reads, "Sometimes all we need is a friend. Connor, aged 8, has autism and was finding it hard to adjust on the first day of school. He was crying by himself until 8-year-old Christian went to console him, and hand in hand, the pair walked into school. I was one of many who felt there must be some onions nearby because my eyes started doing a funny thing." I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We'll be back with a conversation about politicians turning to Hollywood for something other than donations. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Kelly Goff, in for Josh Barrow.
On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. We know that great screenwriters are great storytellers. We also know that Democratic politicians have traditionally turned to Hollywood to write checks for their campaigns. But last election cycle, 30 Democratic congressional candidates in swing districts turned to three prominent screenwriters for help with messaging to help them tell stories that connect with voters in the heartland. 21 of those candidates actually won, including some in GOP strongholds. Dubbed the Hollywood Three by Vanity Fair magazine, these screenwriters turned advisors are Billy Ray, known for writing the film The Hunger Games, Marshall Herskovitz, known for writing one of my favorite shows, the 90s teen drama My So-Called Life, and Greg Hurwitz, best-selling author of the Orphan X series and a writer for a host of television series, including Queen of the South. Greg stopped by to tell us how they were able to use the fundamentals of psychology and great storytelling to help Democratic candidates rise above the noise of Twitter to win over voters some had dismissed as unwinnable.
There's a field of personality psychology called Big Five personality theory. A lot of us are familiar with the Myers-Briggs test. That's sort of like the Cliff Note version of that. Introversion, extroversion, neuroticism. And one of the things that liberals are higher in is trait openness and trait empathy. And so openness tends to correlate a lot with creative types. That's why you see it pocketing around Hollywood. We have, you know, a lot of artists tend liberal. At least I always joke that the good ones, like we have Bruce Springsteen, they have Scott Baio, right? It's a sort of unfair distribution if you look at who plays at the Republican conventions. But we tend to make a mistake, and we tend to mistake higher empathy for being something that's a morally superior trait. Conservatives tend higher in a trait called conscientiousness, and that breaks down into orderliness and industriousness. Okay, it's not that they lack empathy; it's that they have something higher in their value structure.
Could I translate that to say maybe like personal responsibility? That's why that comes up a lot among conservatives, right?
Yeah, that's one of the frames, or working hard and being accountable. Yes. But so one of the things is with higher conscientiousness, one of the things that I say to Democrats a lot is before we go and educate conservatives or libertarians or swing voters into higher empathy, we should be aware that higher conscientiousness codes for better health, better finances, more stable marriages, and longer lifespans. So it's pretty tricky to go over and tell people that their whole worldview is lacking. There's also the fact that these are fixed psychological traits. So it's like going up to Cory Booker and saying, Cory, dude, why can't you just be an introvert? This is a base setting. And so the approach that was very important for me when we were looking at the ways that we had failed to connect was we didn't make our argument well. And so one of the approaches that I wanted the candidates to take, and we worked on this, was to make high conscientious arguments for classically liberal values. And we all know this intuitively. We have family members and friends who we talk to differently, who take information in different ways. If we're stuck on an empathy gear and we're just grinding it till the motor breaks, it's not going to work. And so we can hold the same values, but figure out ways that can talk and frame our arguments more convincingly to libertarians and centrist Republicans and all sorts of people if we're willing to get out of our own perspective and be willing to accept the utility of other people's perspectives.
So, and just to clarify that the proof is in the pudding in terms of your strategy working, because you all advised about 30 candidates and 21 of them won, including a number in swing districts, and some of them were even in solid Trump country, like Kendra Horn, who was in a congressional district in Oklahoma that Donald Trump won convincingly. So can you talk us through how you all ended up deciding which candidates you were willing to advise? Because I know that you turned down plenty of people.
Well, I wish that there was a clear strategy from the outset. I mean, looking back on it, what was evident was all 30 were in red districts. We only worked in flip districts. And that it's not like that was a big plan that we set out, but all the messaging that we felt like, where we felt like we had the most to offer was for people where they were running, that D next to their name was a liability, that people had turned off their arguments about abortion and gun control and immigration, that people were no longer listening or willing to hear it. And what we wanted to do is be able to frame arguments in ways that came in through a different angle that could open them up to winning in places where this is very outside the bubble. These are very different frames of mind.
I've joked before that being raised a Democrat in Texas made me a Republican when I moved to the East Village of New York, and I'm actually a registered independent. And I feel that most candidates in the major parties are kind of speaking to the extremist members of their base, which excludes people like me and a lot of people I know. And so one of the things that I know that you really tried to specialize in, Greg, was helping candidates make a compelling message that specifically reaches someone who disagrees with them. And so my first question is, why are so many people in politics so bad at preaching to anyone who is not already in their choir? And can you give me an issue specifically where you helped candidates reach someone who is not in their party to help them win?
So the example that I'll use is when we talk about healthcare. We tend to come into a room and say, universal healthcare is a right. So immediately you've split the entire room by drawing a line that anybody who doesn't agree with you now will not agree with you, you know, whatsoever. And we tend to lean really heavily on an empathy argument. Don't you care about this poor kid who's going to die if he doesn't have a surgery? And if you don't, how dare you? What sort of vile human being are you? But if you're a higher conscientiousness, that argument doesn't hold water because people go, of course I care about that kid, but I can't pay for everybody's kid to have every single surgery, and it doesn't make sense.
And then I won't be able to pay for my own kid.
Right. And that's not the society that we're in. That's not how this works structurally. And so one of the things that we have to do, I think, as liberals is to make sure that people understand the kind of changes that we want to make or the kind of policies that we want to have, but that America can still look and feel like America. But that there are ways we need to care for communities. And so with healthcare, for instance, one of the discussions that we had is to say, look, we already have a baseline of medical care in this country. Now, when people come into emergency rooms and they're uninsured, the hospitals raise the prices on everybody else, which the insurance companies hike the premiums for us, and we wind up paying for it anyways. The average cost of an emergency room visit in the U.S. is $1,233. The average cost of a vaccination is $19. So as dollars and cents people who are paying for this anyways, if we can sidestep whether it's socialism or how it is, if we're just trying to deal with a problem that we have to pay for the most effectively and strategically, what do you think makes sense? Are there certain free market solutions to getting people preventive care? Can we start to have that conversation? Additionally, Canada has a higher rate of entrepreneurism than the United States of America, which is shocking. And one of the reasons for that is that people have healthcare that they can take with them when they go to different places, and they're willing to innovate and they're willing to risk. And guess what? When they do that, they can take big swings and create more jobs, which creates more workers, which creates more taxpayers. And so there's a huge return on investment to figuring out to make sure that we have a threshold, like a sort of safety network beneath people so that they can take those swings as they're building their future in a capitalist society in order to make more headway and to create more jobs and more wealth.
So you just made an argument for how universal healthcare is actually better for business as opposed to freebie giveaways of socialism. But let me ask you this, Greg. You know, one of the reasons I was interested in speaking with you, and I'm interested in the work that you all have been doing, is I'm wondering if our country is less divided between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, and divided by people who are open to having conversations with people who disagree with them and people who are not. I have friends of every race and political persuasion under the sun, and it has never bothered me to sit at a dinner and have a conversation with someone I disagree with. Now, obviously, if I find someone to be egregiously, you know, racist or sexist, and they believe that my place is home, barefoot, pregnant in the kitchen, there's not a lot for us to talk about at that point. But if we're just talking about policy differences, it's never bothered me. And yet I know so many people who take the position, if someone feels this way about healthcare or about immigration policy, or they voted for Trump, I have nothing to say to them. What do you think separates people who are willing to have the conversations from people who are not?
Boy, that's a good question. First of all, I think there's way more people like you and me in this country than we think. And I think there's sort of a chihuahua effect that comes out of social media, right? That you just feel like that there's these big loud barks, but you're not sure exactly how many people are there. I mean, that number of people who are actually on Twitter is a significant minority of Americans. And then there's a crazy statistic that a very small percentage of them are responsible for 80% of the tweeting. And so I think there's way more people like you and me. And I think America is actually starving to have more civil discourse. Do you remember? I mean, I keep thinking about at the when George W. Bush shared, you know, a candy with Michelle Obama. Do you remember that?
Right, was at the funeral. Oh. Yes, at the funeral. Yeah.
Everybody is dying to just be able to have conversations without this constant drumbeat that everyone are, you know, raging socialists who are going to turn us into riotous Venezuela, you know, or that they're evil racists who are, you know, who everyone's a Nazi who we disagree with. There's a lot of people who are in the middle and a lot of people who can point to specific policies. And there are some specific policies that are egregious, I think, and that are morally reprehensible and that we need to go after and we need to fight for. But we have to fight by making arguments and winning votes. We have to win the House. It was one of the reasons why we focused on the House. We thought the best bulwark that we could get in there to an administration with whose views we did not agree was to flip one of the houses. And that was our focus. But guess what? You know, a lot of the bills that they're pushing forth are just dying on McConnell's desk right now in the Senate. And so people aren't aware of that. If people just follow the news, they think that all this new House, this new Democratic House has been doing is trying to impeach Donald Trump. And they've passed, you know, dozens and dozens of bills and legislation about prescription drug prices, about clean government, about violent history checks, all these policies that are all the things why they were elected to go there. And so we got to get those stories out. I think that one of the things that's very important is that there are people like you having conversations like this, because the more we can shatter that spell of pluralistic ignorance and the more that we can let people know that there are smart people out there like you who are willing to have enlightenment discourse, who are willing to be proven wrong, who are willing to look at your own confirmation bias, who are willing to gather more information, who are willing to join hands with people, friends, colleagues, politicians who they may not agree with on every single thing, but you can find some common ground and get some things done. Imagine what a boring, miserable world we would have if we were all only friends with people who agreed with us on every single point.
What's particularly interesting to me is there would be no President Donald Trump were it not for The Apprentice. And so his Hollywood ties run deep, and yet I think he's done a really good job of reinforcing the stereotype that you have the coastal elites of, you know, media in New York and then Hollywood in, you know, in California, and then you have real Americans somewhere in the middle. And I think that the stereotype that he's helped kind of perpetrate is that people like you certainly don't exist in Hollywood. Do you think that he's done a good job of sort of reinforcing and sort of driving a wedge between this idea that people like you can connect with Americans who are not on the coast?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a brilliant, intuitive strategist. And for some reason that I don't understand, the Democrats are not willing to shatter the frame and shatter the game that he keeps asking them to play. And they keep plodding onward as he sets the rules of the game. And so when he was talking about, you know, for the four congresswomen in the squad to go back to where they came from, which is obviously, you know, a vile statement with pretty hideous overtones, rather than everybody scrambling into the mix to in support and shoring it up. I mean, it's a very clearly is a calculated move to get the whole party back aligned and defined by the most left members by saying something vile about them. Imagine if someone had just come out and said, look, we all know this game. Donald Trump tweets something vile. We all then scramble the Democrats to prove how unracist we are, right? And we dutifully tweet and say all these other things. And then his base points to us and says, see, Democrats only don't really care about real Americans and polarization gets worse. So this game that he plays that isn't a game that deals with adult governance is no longer something we're going to give oxygen to. And instead, what we really want to talk about is job creation.
But Greg, this goes back to, I think, what you said earlier, right, which is he's not the only one playing a game, because there were a lot of certain liberal members of Congress who fundraised a lot of money that week because of what he said.
Absolutely. What do we want to do? Do you want to raise money and signal the things that can raise the most money? Or do you want to call out what the situation is? Now, I have a contention that if somebody was actually willing to rear up and call out the rules of the game, that would be more effective from a fundraising perspective. But people are too scared to do it. I mean, are we going to continue to react to this to the game in the way that he plays it. And my contention is that somebody who's willing to stand up and just shatter the rules of the game in a way that evinces true leadership, people will pivot and look at it. And people will, that's where you're going to raise money, and that's where you're going to break the cycle. And until somebody can, they're going to go with somebody who has the trappings of leadership, which I think Trump does.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Former FBI Director James Comey declared vindication after the release of an IG report over his leaks of memos after he was fired by President Trump. It's true that Comey didn't commit a crime, but he did flagrantly violate FBI rules, something he'd be a little more abashed about if he weren't an incredibly sanctimonious figure who really believed and believes the rules shouldn't apply to him.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
This time of year, you always run into people who say, don't act like it's fall just yet. It's still summer. It's summer until mid-September. I know it's technically summer until mid-September, but in my heart, it's already fall the day August ends. Don't be sad it's over. Summer was long. Fall's going to be great.
For my rant, there was a lot of hand-wringing this week over a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll that tracks the values Americans hold most dear. Over the last two decades, four core values have emerged: hard work, commitment to religion, patriotism, and having children. Hard work remains the only traditionally American value that hasn't slipped among millennials, while the goal of having children has slipped the most. This shouldn't surprise anyone. Studies have shown American birth rates are at an all-time low. So is church attendance. But get this, two-thirds of millennials actually believe in heaven. Studies have also shown that millennials volunteer for charitable groups more than other groups, and more millennial fathers are requesting paternity leave. Studies have also found that student loan debt is one reason a lot of millennials don't plan on having children. Not having kids you can't take care of actually shows millennials prioritize being responsible citizens over becoming parents at any cost. And while the word patriotic has been sullied in part by white supremacist groups co-opting the word patriot, millennials I know advocate and protest on issues they care about to try to make our country better. That, to me, is the very definition of patriotic. So I'm not worried about millennial values, and you shouldn't either. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Greg Hurwitz. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Colin Cab Washington is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And I'm Kelly Goff. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.